This is The Wealthy Bookheads, where we interview important books that can change your life. I'll ask the questions, and I'll let the book do the talking using words from its own pages. This is essentially a book interview. Your time is valuable, so let's get started. Today, I'll be interviewing The Psychology of Money, Timeless Lessons on Wealth, Greed, and Happiness by Morgan Housel. It's sold over 8 million copies, has an overall rating of 4.7 on Amazon, and 78% of the reviewers call it a 5-star book. Question number one, what's the book about? Answer, the premise of this book is that doing well with money has little to do with how smart you are and a lot to do with how you behave. And behavior is hard to teach, especially to really smart people. The aim of this book is to use short stories to convince you that soft skills are more important than the technical side of money. I'll do this in a way that will help everyone make better financial decisions. Question. In the book, you mention a soft skill that's vital to wealth building, namely, knowing when enough is enough. Can you retell the story of John Bogle? Answer. John Bogle, the Vanguard founder who passed away in 2019, once told a story about money that highlights something we don't think about enough. At a billionaire's party, a friend informs his pal, Joseph Heller, that their host, a hedge fund manager, had made more money in a single day than Heller had earned from his wildly popular novel, Catch-22, over its whole history. Heller responds, "Yes, but I have something he'll never have. Enough." Bogle continues, "Enough." I was stunned by the simple eloquence of that word. Stunned for two reasons. First, because I've been given so much in my own life. And second, because Joseph Heller couldn't have been more accurate. For a critical element of our society, including many of the wealthiest and most powerful among us, there seems to be no limit today on what enough entails. Question. I think we all understand this idea of living below our means. So why is it so hard for so many smart people to practice financial restraint in the real world? Answer. It's because the hardest financial skill is getting the goalpost to stop moving. The danger occurs when the taste of having more, more money, more power, more prestige, increases your ambition faster than your satisfaction. In that case, one step forward pushes the goalpost two steps ahead. An insatiable appetite for more will push you to the point of regret. Think of it this way. The only way to know how much food you can eat is to eat until you're sick. Few try this because vomiting hurts more than any meal tastes good. But for some reason, the same logic doesn't translate to business and investing. Many will only stop reaching for more when they either break or are forced to stop. The only way to win is to accept that you might have enough, even if it's less than those around you. Life just isn't fun without a sense of enough. Question. And in the book, you say that knowing we have enough means living below our egos. What exactly do you mean by this phrase? Answer. Past a certain level of income, what you need is just what sits below your ego. Everyone needs the basics. Once they're covered, there's another level of comfortable basics. And past that, there's basics that are both comfortable, entertaining, and enlightening. But spending beyond a pretty low level of materialism is mostly a reflection of ego approaching income. It's a way to spend money to show people that you have, or at least you had, money. This must stop if you want wealth. One of the most powerful ways to increase our savings isn't to raise our income, is to raise our humility. When you define savings as the gap between your ego and your income, you realize why so many smart people with decent incomes save so little. People with enduring personal financial success tend to have a propensity to not give a damn what others think about them. Question. And this propensity for not giving a damn is vital to becoming wealthy instead of just being rich. What's the difference and why does it matter? Answer: we should be careful to define the difference between wealthy and rich. It's more than semantics. Not knowing the difference is a source of countless poor money decisions. Rich is current income. Someone driving a $100,000 car is almost certainly rich, because even if they purchase the car with debt, you still need a certain level of income to afford the monthly payment. Same goes with those who live in a big house. It's not hard to spot rich people. They often go out of their way to make themselves known. But wealth is hidden. It's income not spent. Wealth is an option not taken. Its value lies in offering you options, flexibility, and growth to one day purchase more stuff than you could possibly imagine right now, or to one day have more options than you have right now. The only way to be wealthy is to not spend the money you have. It's not just the only way to accumulate wealth, it's the very definition of wealth. Question: and this accumulation of wealth, you say in the book, requires saving without a spending goal. Can you explain what this means? Answer: you don't need a specific reason to save. Some people save money for a down payment on a house or a new car or for retirement. That's great, of course. But savings does not require a goal of purchasing something specific. You can save just for saving's sake, and indeed you should. Everyone should. Because everyone's life is a continuous chain of surprises. Savings that aren't earmarked for anything in particular, that's a hedge against life's inevitable ability to surprise the hell out of you at the worst possible moment. Just save. You don't need a specific reason to save. It's great to save for a car or a down payment or a medical emergency, but saving for things that are impossible to predict or to define is one of the best reasons to save. Question: speaking of future events that are impossible to predict, you stress that financial success is primarily about survival. How so? Answer: if I had to summarize money success in a single word, it would be survival. Not growth, or brains, or insight. The ability to stick around for a long time, without getting wiped out or being forced to give up, is what makes the biggest difference. This should be the cornerstone of your strategy, whether it's in investing, or your career, or a business that you own. The biggest single point of failure with money is sole reliance on a paycheck to fund short-term spending needs, with no savings in the bank to create a gap between what you think you need in the future and what you might really need in the future. The trick is realizing that you don't need a specific reason to save. I save a lot, and I have no idea what I'll be using the savings for in the future. Most financial plans that only prepare you for known risks do not have enough margin of safety to survive in the real world. In fact, the most important part of every plan is planning on your plan, not going according to plan. Question: well, that sounds a bit scary. Why are you so sure that most financial plans won't go according to plan? Answer: because things that have never happened before happen all the time. They're called surprises. At a 2017 dinner I attended in New York, Daniel Kahneman was asked how investors should respond when our forecasts are wrong. He said, whenever we're surprised by something, even if we admit that we made a mistake, we usually say, oh well, I'll never make that mistake again. But in fact, what you should learn when you make a mistake because you couldn't anticipate something is that the world is difficult to anticipate. The correct lesson from surprises is that the world is surprising. We should use past surprises as an admission that we have no idea what might happen next. The most important economic events in the future, things that will move the needle the most, are things that history gives us no reason to know about. Question: so let's talk about what to do about these future surprises. In the book, you mentioned three aspects of what you call the survival mindset. What's the first one? Answer: applying this survival mindset to the real world comes down to appreciating three things. Number one, you must want to be financially unbreakable more than you want big returns. For example, no one wants to hold cash during a bull market. They want to own assets that go up. You look and feel conservative holding cash during a bull market because you become acutely aware of how much return you're giving up by not owning the good stuff. For example, let's say that cash earns 1% and stocks return 10% a year. The 9% gap will gnaw at you every day. But if that cash prevents you from having to sell your stocks during a bear market, the actual return you earned on that cash is not 1% a year. It can be many multiples of that, because preventing one desperate ill-timed stock sale can do more for your lifetime returns than picking dozens of big-time winners. Question: what's the second aspect of the survival mindset? Answer: number two, planning is important, but the most important part of every plan is to plan on the plan, not going according to plan. A plan is only useful if it can survive reality, and a future filled with unknowns is everyone's reality. A good plan embraces it and emphasizes room for error. The more you need specific elements of a plan to be true, the more fragile your financial life becomes. For example, you want enough room for error in your savings rate to be able to say, it would be great if the market returns 8% a year over the next 30 years, but if it only does 4% a year, I'll still be okay. The more room for error in your plan, the more valuable your plan becomes. Many bets fail not because they were wrong, but because they were mostly right in a situation that required things to be exactly right. Room for error, often called margin of safety, is one of the most underappreciated forces in finance, and it comes in many forms: a frugal budget, flexible thinking, and a loose timeline. Anything that lets you live happily with a broad range of outcomes. Question: so what's the third part of the survival mindset? Answer: number three, it's vital to have a split personality, optimistic about the future, but paranoid about what will prevent you from getting to the future. Optimism is usually defined as a belief that things will always go well, but that's incomplete. Sensible optimism is a belief that the odds are in your favor, and over time, things will balance out to a good outcome, even if what happens in between is filled with misery. And in fact, you know it will be filled with misery. You can be optimistic that the long-term growth trajectory is up and to the right, but equally sure that the road between now and then is filled with landmines and always will be. Those two things are not mutually exclusive. The idea that something can gain over the long run while being a basket case in the short run is not intuitive, but that's how a lot of things work in life. Question: speaking of a basket case in the short term, you advise us to view the stock market's volatility as an admission fee that we pay for long-term returns. Explain that. Answer: successful investing looks easy when you're not the one doing it. But do you know how hard it is to maintain a long-term outlook when stocks are collapsing? Like everything else worthwhile, successful investing demands a price. But its price is not dollars and cents. It's volatility, fear, doubt, uncertainty, and regret, all of which are easy to overlook until you're dealing with them in real time. Very few investors have the disposition to say, I'm actually fine if I lose 20% of my money. This is doubly true for investors who have never experienced a 20% decline. But if you view volatility as a fee, things just might look different. Market returns are never free and never will be. They demand a price that you pay, just like any other product. The volatility uncertainty fee, the price of returns, is the cost of admission to get returns greater than low fee parks like cash and bonds. The trick is convincing yourself that the market's fee is worth it. That's the only way to properly deal with volatility and uncertainty. Not just putting up with it, but realizing that it's an admission fee that's worth the price. Question. You say the stress of the stock market is a fee worth paying, so the question is why? What's the greatest value of becoming wealthy, in your opinion? Answer. People want to become wealthier to make them happier. Happiness is a complicated subject because everyone's different. But if there's a common denominator in happiness, a universal fuel of joy, it's that people want to control their lives. The ability to do what you want, when you want, with who you want, for as long as you want, is priceless. It's the highest dividend money pays. More than your salary, more than the size of your house, more than the prestige of your job, control over doing what you want, when you want to, with people you want to, is the broadest lifestyle variable that makes people happy. Money's greatest intrinsic value then, and this can't be overstated, is its ability to give you control over your time. The highest form of wealth is the ability to wake up in the morning and say, I can do whatever I want today. Question. It's time to wind down this interview. When it's all said and done, how do you invest your own money? Answer. My wife and I met in college and moved in with each other years before we got married. After school, we both had entry-level jobs with entry-level pay. We settled for a moderate lifestyle. Comfortable, but nothing close to fancy. Despite more than a decade of rising incomes, myself in finance, my wife in healthcare, we've more or less stayed at that lifestyle ever since. That's pushed our savings rate continuously higher. Virtually every dollar of raise has accrued to savings, our independence fund. If there's a part of our household financial plan I'm most proud of, it's that we got the goalpost of lifestyle to stop moving at a young age. It's not that our aspirations are non-existent. We like nice stuff and live comfortably. We just got the goalpost to stop moving. In fact, we're so far committed to the independence camp that we've done things that make little sense on paper. We own our own house without a mortgage. We also keep a higher percentage of our assets in cash than most financial advisors would recommend, something around 20% of our assets outside the value of our house. I've changed my investment strategy in the past, so of course, there's a chance I'll change it in the future. But still, no matter how we save or invest, I'm sure we'll always have the goal of independence. On top of that, we'll always do whatever maximizes our ability to sleep well at night. And finally, my favorite quotes from the book are as follows. The hardest financial skill is getting the goalpost to stop moving. People with enduring personal financial success tend to have a propensity to not give a damn what others think about them. If I had to summarize money success in a single word, it would be survival. The most important part of every plan is planning on your plan, not going according to plan. Money's greatest intrinsic value is its ability to give you control over your time. Life just isn't any fun without a sense of enough. And that's it for this book interview with The Psychology of Money. Timeless Lessons on Wealth, Greed, and Happiness by Morgan Housel. You've been listening to The Wealthy Bookheads, where we interview important books that can change your life. You can order this book in the links below or on our website if you'd like to help our cause. It puts a few pennies in our pockets without taking any extra pennies from yours. As always, thank you for your time.